Okay. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's talk.
The one-off lecture.
And we're very, very proud to have Ed Davey here this evening. He is an alumnus of the MSc in Environmental Development. Most of you are current students of Environmental Development. We're very pleased to have him back here after, 11, 12 years? Yeah. You can see how she's grown up last long. So I'm just going to quickly introduce Ed and then hand over to him. So he started his career as a student, as we all do, as an undergraduate at Oxford, studying modern languages, before making his way here to Addison to study the MSc in Environment Development in 2008, 9. That was actually just before I came here, so we didn't overlap. But back in those days, we did have lecture theatre and licenses. After he finished at MSc, he then did a number of different roles. He worked at Oxfam as a researcher and for the United Nations Human Development Report. Then spent a number of years working in the Middle East, working for a humanitarian organisation. Very eclectic career. From there, he went to Bogota to work as lead advisor on environment with the Colombian Presidency's International Cooperation Office there. And then following that, he moved on to work on behalf of the Prince of Wales, which was a very lovely man, and worked for his International Sustainability Union, where he co-led on a number of initiatives on reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. And I believe forests are a particular passion of yours, as they are of mine. Following that now, going to the present time, Ed now works for the World Resources Institute, where he is a director of the Geographic Deep Dive in the Food and Land Use Coalition. This is a global initiative to try and transform the world's food and land use system. So he's responsible for a number of different countries there, including Colombia, but also Ethiopia, Indonesia, China, India, and Australia. So there's a number of works coming out of the WRI, but I'd like to let Ed take over. In particular, with Ed has just released a new book, Given Half a Chance. This has just been published over this year. This is the first edition. He has some copies here. It's a lovely read. Ed writes very, very clearly about some of the most salient issues of the day with regards to the environment and also the climate as well. So I let Ed talk about it in his own words, if you'd like to.
Thank you, Charlie, very, very much, and thank you all so much for coming. It's lovely to be back at the LSE. I had a wonderful year here from 2007 to 2008, made many wonderful friends, and it's lovely to see Joanna Setzer, who's now teachers here at the LSE, and I'd like to pay tribute, really, to a number of wonderful teachers here, including Stuart Corbridge and Sylvia Chant and Robert Faulkner, Tim Dyson, Tim Allen, Eric Neumeyer, Richard Perkins, Nick Stern. It was a really incredible master's, and it whizzed by in the blink of an eye, and I'm very happy and very touched to be back here all those years later. So I'm going to talk for around half an hour, no more, hopefully less, and then I'd love to have questions and answers, and we'll close at 7. Charlie's a dad, he's got a young child, I've got a young child, so we're going to run home at 7, but thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I wanted to do three things, really, in the talk. The first was to give a little introduction to the book and the process of writing the book and the spirit behind the book. And then I wanted to go into the 10 paths to a hopeful future that I set out in the book. And then in the third section of the talk, just talk briefly about 10 things that have really happened since the book was published, or at least since the book was written. Because this world of ours is changing very, very fast and in complex and challenging ways. And already the book, in some respects, I think, is somewhat obsolete. But nevertheless, I'll run you through it. So I started writing it in around July 2016. It was a happy time then, I felt, for those of us working on global environmental issues, because the year prior, 2015, the world had signed these two very significant global agreements. One was the UN Sustainable Development Goals, that I'm sure you all know off by heart. And then, of course, there was the Paris Agreement in December 2015. And what I wanted to do was capture effectively what I felt was a spirit of global optimism that we felt in 2016 about this new world that we had somehow envisaged in 2015. And I then spent effectively 9 months or so doing 50 or so interviews with many of the people who were really involved in those negotiations, plus other environmentalists and thinkers. And most of those interviews are available on YouTube. Then my son Ollie was born in April 2017. And at that point, like many young parents, all other projects on your desk basically go on hold. And over the subsequent year, I didn't manage to do all that much writing, but I carried on thinking about the issues and so on. And then in around May 2018, I was able to finish writing the book, putting it all together, and I submitted it to my publisher, Unbound. I should say the book was crowdfunded, so around 160 people contributed to funding the book. And some people gave as little as £10 and others gave more, and that was the whole process in itself. And somewhat to my amazement, the book was published in April 2019. But what I wanted to do, basically, was to try and tell an optimistic story about how we can still put the world on a better track. And having now worked on the environment for 10-plus years or so, many of us, I think, struggle. You know, we're doing our best. We're incredibly committed, all of us working in this field. But we are often confronted, in fact, daily confronted with, in a sense, the bad news of how we're not winning or we're not making enough progress. And that is as true now today as it was when I started writing it. Nevertheless, what I wanted to do was draw attention to a whole number of things that are happening right around the world, involving governments and communities and companies, where things really are going in the right direction. And although that's not yet happening at sufficient scale to put the planet on a better course, nevertheless, there's a lot of cause for hope. And so in a sense, the spirit of the book was, yes, we can. This is how we can do it. And I really tried to be disciplined in writing it, not to spend too much time diagnosing the problem, but actually describing as much as I could where already we're seeing signs of what we could do differently. And that's hard. But I think it's a discipline that's worth doing because a lot of the time, a lot of people out there feel very depressed about the global effort to address climate change and the natural environment, depletion of the natural environment. But actually, I think people feel very inspired when they see what's happening, what's positive. And if you look at the amazing recent David Attenborough series on the Blue Planet, and also the one called Climate Change, The Facts, which actually was screened on the same day that my book was published by complete chance in April 2019. You know, most of those documentaries spend around 80 to 90% looking at the problem, and then at the very end, there's a sort of 5 to 10% bit which talks about the solution. And although in the book I don't think I've done the other way around, it's not 90% the solution, 10% the problem. Nevertheless, it's around 50-50, and I think that's a better balance. So, very briefly, the book sets out 10 paths to save the world or to a better future. And I wanted to sort of rattle through them quite quickly and then go on to the third bit, which is around 10 things that are now happening, really, since I wrote the book. So the first path in the book is around renewable energy and a full frontal effort to address the climate crisis. And what I tried to do in that chapter was describe the extent to which the global fossil fuel companies are committed to a trajectory which is not consistent with the Paris Agreement, and effectively the global effort to try and encourage those companies and encourage economies around the world to go on a transition to renewable energy or to the low-carbon economy. And here in the UK, we've now made this quite impressive commitment to a low-carbon economy by 2050, net zero carbon. And around the world, there are a number of countries which seem to be very serious about making that transition. Having said that, it's also plainly the case that we are not on a trajectory at the present which is consistent with the Paris Agreement. And so in that chapter, I describe a number of efforts that are happening, both to talk about stranded assets, and I talk about Mark Carney and the Bank of England and what's being done by the financial sector to really contemplate this whole issue that we cannot possibly burn the oil and gas reserves which remain. But I also found myself describing the Mission Innovation, which was established by 23 governments in the Paris Agreement, and I think with 23 philanthropists, including Bill Gates, which is basically a massive global effort to try to fund the technologies of tomorrow, which might enable us, if we're fast, to move to a low-carbon trajectory. So that's the first chapter. And the chapter also makes some reference to the need to adapt to climate change, but fundamentally it's about mitigation. The second path is, as Charlie mentioned, tropical forests, but also boreal forests. And you know, of the 10 chapters in the book, it's probably the most personal one in a sense, because when I lived in Colombia, I worked for 3.5 years to try to protect Colombia's extraordinary rainforests, both in the Amazon, but also in the Pacific coast of Colombia, which is a pretty astonishing place. And I describe efforts around the world to protect the forests. And actually, there's quite a significant chunk of that chapter which describes what happened in Brazil in the period of previous governments, where effectively the country managed to achieve in the order of an 80% reduction in deforestation from the period of around 2006 to 2012. And that was as a result of commitment from the private sector, from the national government. There was an astonishing environment minister, Marina da Silva, at the time, who really sought to enforce government legislation to reduce deforestation. There was international support to Brazil to achieve that. But critically, it was to do, I think, with a number of major international and Brazilian companies which committed to reduce deforestation from their supply chains. But in that chapter, I also describe efforts happening in West Africa, in the Gola rainforest, in Canada with the boreal forest there, to really protect those forests. And I basically make the argument that without doing that, we cannot meet the world's climate change goals. And I think, hearteningly, the world is waking up to that. And there are some success stories in Indonesia over the last 2 years, although there's terrible forest fires happening at the moment. There has actually been quite a significant reduction in deforestation. But, of course, there is a massive worry at the moment, in particular, I'm afraid to say, about Brazil, and I'll come back to that later. The third chapter is around sustainable agriculture and protecting the world's soil. And there I describe a number of efforts around the world to farm more sustainably. Now, some of that might be organic agriculture, but some of it's much more around making current agricultural systems more ecological and more sustainable and more regenerative without necessarily transitioning to a completely organic system. And I describe in Ethiopia one particular landscape which I've come to know and love, where the community basically, after a terrible tragedy in the 1980s, which was famine as a result of conflict, but also the changing climate, have managed to completely restore that landscape through better management of the soil and of the land. And communities which previously had to leave that landscape because it had become effectively unviable are now living there and deriving a dignified life from the land. And in a sense, that landscape in Ethiopia, and it's also happened in China in the lowest plateau, has become a kind of emblematic sign of where, if you really put your mind to it, you can restore the earth. If a community is really committed to managing the land sustainably, it's possible to do that. And so the third chapter documents a number of examples of where farming and land is being managed more sustainably. The fourth chapter is on fresh water, and there I talk about a number of examples of where countries and communities have been effectively trying to manage the water, finite fresh water, more sustainably. In particular, one area in Rajasthan in northern India where communities have effectively returned to some quite traditional ways of managing fresh water, involving basically a very intimate relationship with the local landscape, small-scale levees and dams, better irrigation systems and so on. And I also talk about in the Middle East, in southern Iraq, where after the conflict that Saddam Hussein waged against the marsh Arabs in the late 1990s, that extraordinary landscape of the marshlands of southern Iraq had basically been completely decimated. But since 2003 and the fall of Saddam Hussein, through some very careful work done by local partners and the UN Environment Agency, something of around 45% of the fresh water that had characterized that landscape for millennia has come back. And in a sense, that's the theme of the book. Given half a chance, nature can restore itself. You know, all of the impact that we're having is not irreversible, but we've got to give nature the chance to sort of recover its health and its resilience. So the fourth chapter is around fresh water, and there's also some material in there around drinking water and sanitation, because clearly we've got a huge amount still to do on that agenda. Then the fifth chapter is on biodiversity, and I talk about a number of landscapes around the world where communities, again, and governments are working to protect biodiversity, and one of those landscapes is in northern Kenya, where effectively African communities, Maasai Mara communities from northern Kenya, have come to an agreement with conservation agencies around managing the landscape in such a way as to preserve Maasai traditions, but also enable elephants and rhinos and other species to flourish in that landscape, lions and so on. And I make the argument that effectively communities can benefit from conservation if it's done right and in ways that respect their rights and their livelihoods. The sixth chapter is on the ocean. This was really challenging. I mean, in a sense, it's the Wild West. It's poorly governed. There are huge issues. And in a sense, the biggest sort of macro threat that the ocean faces is ocean acidification, which is driven by the changing climate. So if you really want to safeguard the ocean's health, we need to address climate change on land, or globally. But equally, we also need to address more immediate drivers of depletion of the ocean, including unsustainable marine fisheries. And there's quite a lot to be done around marine protected areas, which are underrepresented and not very well governed. And also better ocean governance. You know, there are something like 150 global treaties which in some way pertain to the ocean. But really, there's an absence of governance of the high seas, and that needs to be urgently addressed. The seventh chapter is cities. I hope Sylvia Chant likes the chapter. She was the great teacher on cities when I was here. I learned a lot from Sylvia. And there I describe how clearly we're in an urban century, and that will only become more and more the case. I think I mentioned briefly Curitiba, where I believe you're from, and a number of examples, Copenhagen, Stockholm, even London, where you know a lot of very good things have been done on the sustainable urbanization agenda. The eighth path to a hopeful future is around waste and the circular economy. You know, it is staggering, it's such a failure that we are wasting around a third of the food that the world produces every day. And that's wasted in different ways, in our fridges, but also in the farm and in between the farm and the fork. And that, you know, surely has to be a massive moral and economic challenge of our times to resolve. But also it's about waste more broadly, it's about plastic, it's about the consumption society, and it's about the urgent need to pivot towards a circular economy. And I describe a number of conversations with companies like Unilever that are making some steps in the right direction to bring about a circular economy. The ninth path is around demography, but I wanted to tackle demography in partnership with two other issues, diet and consumption, because clearly population growth is happening and is likely to continue right through the century to come. I was very persuaded by Tim Dyson's amazing lectures here at the LSE around the demographic transition, and also the way that Tim always made it clear that it's not just about population growth per se, but also about the ecological impact in the sense that every individual has, and how that varies hugely according to country and economic class and so on. And so I've always been very persuaded that we need to be very clear that it's also about people's consumption and taking people's pressure off, everybody's pressure off the earth, but particularly those who have a very strong consumption footprint. And part of that is manifested through diet. And I'm very persuaded, and it comes up quite frequently in the book, that in large parts of the world, particularly in the West, we need to eat much less meat, particularly red meat. But that's not universally the case, and in some of the countries that are described in the book, such as Ethiopia, there's a malnutrition to protein deficit, and actually people in that country largely deserve to and have the right to eat more animal protein. But certainly in large parts of the world, we're eating too much meat, particularly processed meat and red meat. It's not good for our health, and it's definitely not good for the climate. So that chapter explores some of those issues. And then the last chapter basically calls for a Marshall Plan for our times to protect and restore the global environment. And I try to make the argument in that chapter that we need action on so many different fronts: politics, economics, the faith community, who've got billions of followers, the media and social media, the law, I think it's an incredibly powerful instrument, but also through global public campaigns and the like. But above all, I think in that chapter, I make the argument, you know, we need a really significant global political agreement and set of commitments from countries to undertake this transition over the next few years. And I should say that the book begins and ends with short chapters about my son, Ollie, because in a sense, when he was born in April 2017, you know, his arrival in the world really concentrated my mind like never before about what kind of world he will grow up in. But not just Ollie, but all of the children, you know, born at around that time. And it really does concentrate your mind. So there are brief chapters at the beginning and the end where I describe my love for him and my concern for the world that he's going to grow up in. So that's the sort of the book in a nutshell. It's intended for a general reader. It hasn't been peer reviewed. It hasn't got loads of references in true OSE fashion. But it's a sort of passionate personal take on the issues. But I wanted to close in the sort of 5 minutes or so, maybe the next 5 to 10 minutes, and then really open it up to questions and answers with 10 thoughts, because in a sense, a lot's happened in this period since the book was finished and since it then came out, because I finished writing the book in around May, June 2018, but it didn't come out until April of this year. The first thing is happening right now, of course, on the streets of London. You will have all seen it. It's Extinction Rebellion. And it's not just Extinction Rebellion, it's also the amazing arrival on the world scene of very eloquent young people, including, of course, Greta Thunberg, but also lots of others like her. And I do think this has been an incredible development. Neither Greta nor Extinction Rebellion feature in the book, because when I put the finishing touches to the book, we didn't know about them. Well, I certainly didn't, but I don't think many did. I think maybe Greta had begun her solitary sitting on the steps of the Stockholm Parliament. But, you know, it is absolutely astonishing what's happened. And I do think it's been incredibly powerful what Greta has done and the way her voice and her clarity and her articulation of the challenge and her simple message about the importance of the science has sort of cut through globally. And I hope she wins the Nobel Prize tomorrow. I don't know if she will. I mean, there are lots of good candidates. But that has been incredible. And then relatedly, I think it's pretty amazing what's happening here in London with Extinction Rebellion. And although I think they're probably dividing opinion, which is problematic, and there are probably significant chunks of the UK population who are sceptical, critical, I also think they've engendered a huge amount of popular sympathy. And I think they've been very creative, very brave, very, very correct, morally correct about what they're saying. And I think it's been pretty amazing to see Extinction Rebellion come into our lives. And as I walked to the LSE today down an empty Strand, you know, that very polluted central road in London, I thought, my God, you know, this is really changing things. So that's the first development I wanted to reference. And if I were to write another book or to update this book, I would certainly begin with Greta and make reference to XR. The second really big issue is in my book, China. And I reference in the book Xi Jinping's commitment to an ecological civilization, which I believe to be sincerely felt. But, of course, there are very, very significant challenges in China, and chief among them is this Belt and Road Initiative. You know, it's in the order of 80 countries. It's a massive infrastructure and development project. In some respects, it's outsourcing the environmental depletion and pollution that's currently happening within China to other countries, just as has happened historically with industrialized countries. But in my view, it could be done very, very badly in ways which are inimical to global climate change goals and biodiversity goals. But equally, you know, it could be an opportunity to do things better. And the Chinese government has established a task force to, quote-unquote, green the BRI. And the World Resources Institute is engaged in that exercise. And I think that will be really determinant in terms of how this whole story plays out over the next 10 years or so. And of course, it's linked to broader changes in China, greater concern among many Chinese about environmental pollution and the need to act. And it's also tied to next year's very important meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity in Kunming in China in October. And I think this is really an opportunity to foster Chinese leadership in terms of the protection and restoration of the natural world. They have been a leader on climate in recent years, of course. They were conspicuously modest in what they said at the UN Climate Leaders Summit 2 weeks ago. But how Chinese leadership on climate and the environment plays out including in its partner countries on the BRI, is, I think, a huge issue, which I touched on briefly in the book, but which I think has become even more urgent since I finished it. Closer to home, point three, I think the EU, including the UK for the time being, although, alas, we are, of course, it seems, very likely to exit very soon, is hugely important. And I've been very encouraged by the new head of the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen's vision of a Green New Deal, and how that plays out, and whether she and Frans Timmermans and the other key power brokers in the EU who are really in charge of that whole effort, the extent to which they prevail in a complex political time in the EU, with a shift to the right in some respects, real challenges in many countries, will be hugely important. And I have a lot of faith in the European project to deliver strong climate and environmental leadership. And even though the UK is exiting, I really hope that the UK will continue to play a partnership role with the EU over the coming years, particularly as we approach the UK climate change conference, the succession to Paris in Glasgow in December next year. The fourth issue in my book is Indonesia. I don't know if there are any Indonesian students in the room. Hello. Well, you know, your country is so important. It's the fourth largest population. It's also among the top 10 in terms of global emitters. I think it's also the fourth largest emitter of GHGs. It's an amazing country. I've really loved coming to know Indonesia and work there over the last few years. But the Indonesian government has made quite a strong commitment to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 41% by 2030, provided there's international support, and it's by 29% if without that support. And I think President Jokowi, who is re-inaugurated next week on the 20th, clearly has some climate commitment and feeling on this issue. But as I see it, there are two paths in Indonesia, like in every country. One is a path to a low-carbon development future, which the government has itself articulated. But there's also a path which is much less progressive on the climate story and the environment. It's about coal and so on. And how things play out in Indonesia will be fascinating to watch, but I've got a lot of faith in Indonesia and lots of very engaged young people who are very committed. Indonesia is also home to some astonishing rainforests, actually. Papua, West Papua, Aceh, North Kalimantan. And for me, one of the very big questions as well is, will Indonesia pursue the kind of plantation palm oil economy in those areas, or will it pursue an alternative development path in those regions, which basically protects those forests and provides an alternative economic development story for those regions? It's basically the eastern part of the archipelago, which remains really quite astonishingly well covered by wonderful forests as well as marine areas. But if it pursues the same path that's characterized Sumatra and Java and so on, then that will impinge on its climate goals. The fifth challenge is, of course, the US and what happens next year with Trump. Is he re-elected or not? When I started the book, you know, I was very optimistic, but then very soon after I began writing the book, of course, Trump said he would withdraw the US from the Paris Agreement. Then there was this astonishing pushback from, you know, many of the states in the US and many of the companies said, we're still in. And in many respects, you know, lots of very good things are still happening in the US, in cities and in states like California and so on, companies. But nevertheless, Trump has been steadily rolling back a lot of the really best federal legislation on the environment. If he's re-elected next year, you know, some of us think there might be some chance he could pivot again towards better climate action, but, you know, you wouldn't put money on it, frankly. If the Democrats win, of course, it seems like all of the Democrat candidates are very strong on climate in different ways. Some of them are incredibly ambitious, I think, on climate. So how the politics play out in the US, in a sense, is one of the biggest questions on this list. But then the sixth point is India. Modi has just been re-elected. Any Indian students in the room? This is the best thing about the LSE. You know, on any given day, you've got most of these countries in the room. Prime Minister Modi, in some respects, has been very, very strong on climate and the environment. But then in other respects, his record is much more problematic. And, you know, my hope, my earnest hope, is that, like many presidents or prime ministers in their second term, they acquire this kind of Burkean, Rooseveltian commitment to their environmental legacy. That's what I saw with Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, for whom I worked in his second period. You know, he really acquired a very strong commitment to conservation and the environment. And in a sense, if that happens under Modi's leadership in India, that will be hugely important. The seventh challenge, concern, is Brazil and the Amazon rainforest. And the Brazilian Environment Minister, Ricardo Salles, was here in London last week. There's a very bullish tone coming from Brazil about the Amazon and about the environment. And obviously that comes from Bolsonaro himself. So for me, the question is, you know, what happens in Brazil? How will Brazilian society respond to what appears to be a really concerted pushback from parts of the rural lobby against protected areas and indigenous reserves in the Amazon, and I think environmental legislation writ large? And how much capacity is there in Brazil at this time to tell a story about how Brazil can still be a global leader in the environmental space, and as it has been so often in the past few decades? And how do we support those in Brazil who are deeply committed to protecting Brazil's amazing environment, not just the Amazon, but also the Cerrado and other ecosystems? So that's a really great area of concern. But of course, it's not just Brazil. It's across Latin America. The Amazon is shared by 9 countries. And an open question in my mind as well is, you know, how do Colombia and Peru and Ecuador and others respond to what's happening? And there seems to be some signs that Colombia wishes to play a regional leadership role in protecting the Amazon. Ecuador is in a political crisis at the moment. There's some good things happening in Peru, but a huge amount hinges on that whole story and how it plays out. And then there are 3 last areas where I think things have shifted and moved on quite a lot since I wrote the book. The first one is around the Middle East and North Africa. I mean, I think how climate change and conflict play out in that region of the Middle East and North Africa, I think, is hugely important. I talk in the book about how the Syrian conflict was arguably exacerbated by climate change and resource scarcity. It wasn't caused by it, and it's important always to make that clear. But it was certainly fueled by underlying resource scarcity and changing climate back in 2007-08. I'm deeply worried about what's happening in Yemen, in Syria, in Egypt. I'm worried about the politics of transboundary water diplomacy between Egypt, Sudan, South Sudan, and Ethiopia, with the Renaissance Dam that's almost complete in Ethiopia. And I think this combination of kind of the need for those countries to have viable agricultural systems which can feed their population, employ young people and rural people well on the land, how they can better predict and respond to the changing climate through better meteorological information, access to weather information and forecasts and so on. All of those issues of climate change and fragility will play out very powerfully in the Middle East and North Africa in the coming years. And the Marshall Plan that I describe in the book, for me, also really extends to that region, and also point 9 to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. And I think how things play out across the continent will be hugely important. And the rainforests of the Congo Basin, particularly the DRC, are also hugely important globally. They are greatly at risk. And they also, in a sense, underwrite food security and a viable kind of climate across the continent. And there's some amazing recent research which shows how effectively that the rains that are generated through evapotranspiration from the rainforests of the Congo Basin effectively play a part in agricultural systems in the Horn of Africa and the north of Africa. And so if we continue to lose the forests in sub-Saharan Africa and the Congo Basin, that could have a really huge knock-on impact in the north of the continent. So a lot to play for across sub-Saharan Africa, but a number of countries that are really trying to pursue better agricultural policy and protect their ecosystems. And all of this brings me to my last point, which is that 2020 is a really critical year. We have a habit of saying that, those of us working in the environment, and 2015 was another critical year with the SDGs and Paris Agreement. But basically, 2020 sees a few really important things. The first is it's the year when countries come back to the climate convention and say, this is the ambition we're going to enact in our nationally determined contributions to the Paris Agreement. So around the world, you know, governments are working basically to strengthen what were often quite weak, frankly, NDCs, which they submitted for the Paris Agreement. So that's coming to a head in 2020, and there's this huge responsibility on the UK and Italy to deliver a strong meeting of the UNFCCC here in the UK in Glasgow at the end of 2020. So that's happening. The progress towards the SDGs are also being reviewed in September next year. The UN Secretary General, who's been an incredible leader on climate change and sustainable development, is going to call heads of state back to New York in September of next year to declare how they're progressing on the SDGs and on climate. And then right prior to Glasgow, as I've already mentioned, there's this meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity in China for the first time since the beginning of the CBD in October. And so WWF and other NGOs are referring to 2020 as a super year, a year in which there will be a new global deal for nature and people. And so I sort of feel like we've come to a really, really important moment in this whole effort. And the book begins with an account of 2015. And in a sense, here I am before you today on the eve of 2020. And I feel like it's a sort of incredibly important moment in the world and for the future of all of us and all of the people of the world and children in the world. And there are really two paths. There's a current path, in a sense, which doesn't look great at all. Really spiraling climate change, continued loss of the natural world, etc. Ongoing division, conflict, inequality. But then I really feel there's a better path. And at our best, you know, humanity is capable of wonderful things. And it's actually possible, and we know what we need to do. So effectively, it's incumbent on all of us to work incredibly hard over the next period to put humanity and the planet on a better course. And that's the spirit of the book. And students here at the LSE have a huge role to play. So thank you. I'll stop there. I'm very happy to answer questions, to hear perspectives on all of this. I would welcome your thoughts and very happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Very much, Ed, that's a lovely talk. So, yes, guys, it's your turn to have a chance to ask some questions or any comments, you'd like to say, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is well done for pushing the LSE to declare a climate emergency. And I hope that they do, because I think we are in one. I like the fact that the LSE has said, you know, we want to respond in a meaningful fashion, because, of course, I think it was said last night by one of the panelists at the talk that was given by Ed Miliband and Farhana Yameen, maybe you were there, something along the lines of, well, the UK government have declared a climate emergency, but then you could argue they haven't really done anything for the last 5 months. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, in and of its own right, it's just a phrase, in a sense. But if the university really backs it up with meaningful action, then that would be fantastic. So I think it's really important that students call for it. And for me, the obvious thing that they would do would be to divest from their fossil fuel investments, which is something that when I was here, I also called for without much success from memory, which I also called for when I was an undergraduate at Oxford University, and we made some progress. But it's hard for universities to do this, but it's possible. And so it would be really great to know if LSE does do that, because a lot of universities are doing it now. In fact, there are loads of universities in the States and elsewhere who are making progress on that agenda. So that would be one test of how serious the LSE is. But if it doesn't happen here, I mean, I honestly don't know where it will happen, because this is such a hotbed of climate action. So.
Hi, thank you. thanks for the presentation. I do environmental policy with economics as a bachelor's. And actually, because you were talking about the divestment campaign, I'm president of the Eco Society at LSE, and we are continuing this campaign this year, so let's see what LSE does in that way. I have a question regarding your chapter 9 about the demography set and about personal individual consumption patterns as well. And I went to the talk yesterday, and Ed Miliband said at one point, so we need system change that makes individual change possible, but we have not yet found an argument about how these will go together. And my question will be, what do you think, what comes first? So do they have to go hand in hand, and we need kind of an individual change that demands system change, or, what do you say?
It's a very good question, and also thank you for your leadership on the divestment issue. Good luck. I mean, ultimately, I think societies have got to act and governments have got to regulate, and, you know, this is a whole-of-society response. Now, of course, if 9 billion individuals in the world went for it, then societies would respond to that. And frankly, even if governments don't act, it's still important to live well and ethically, and I think we're all on a journey individually, and none of us is perfect. I'm certainly not perfect in terms of our own footprint, and we could all be more consistent and more consequent with our beliefs. So I think individual action is hugely important, and I think everybody wants to know what they can do as an individual, to which my answer is, you know, eat less meat, fly less, you know, live more sustainably at home, and so on and so forth, consume less. But I was sympathetic to Ed Miliband's response because this New Guardian investigation that began this week about some of the biggest emitters, basically, shows that, you know, there are 20 to 30 companies in the world who have huge power, who are disproportionately responsible for the emissions that have happened over the last 50 years, basically. That's how I read it. Now, of course, we all consume the products that they produced and so on, so none of us is exempt. But nevertheless, you know, if we just focus on individual action, we take the burden off governments basically to act and companies to act. So that I hope that answers your question. I think we need both. But ultimately, if I could, I'd say, you know, it's about political leadership and regulation. So.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that just reducing consumption and flying and moving over to a non-meat diet is sufficient? Do you think we should be more advocating a wholesale evolutionary change in our economic systems, or, you know, is it enough to moderate our current pathway?
I don't think it is. I do think we need a fundamentally different economic system. I briefly reference in the book Kate Raworth's book, Donut Economics, which I hope is on every LSE student's curriculum now. And it's a wonderful description of how you could actually reorient the economic system to deliver on the sustainable development goals and on climate action. Having said that, I was also very persuaded by Nick Stern and by the sort of thesis set out here that effectively we need to harness the existing economic system and make it better and make it work for the climate, and, you know, put a massive price on carbon, you know, make the markets work to deliver climate action and so on. And WRI does a lot of work in that area, basically around making the economic case for action within the existing system. But my deepest heartfelt view is that we do need a sort of fundamental reform of the global capitalist economy in some way. But my worry is that to enable that to happen will take longer than the time that we have. But maybe things are changing, the dislocation that's happening and Extinction Rebellion and so on. Maybe there's much more appetite and openness to doing that now than there ever has been. So I'm a bit sort of conflicted on this, really. I'm basically a radical at heart, but I'm also quite pragmatic about working within the system that we have and trying to do both, in a sense. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I don't know. Is there a hand behind you? Does anyone have a hand up?
I just wanted to follow up on that. So if you compare degrowth and green growth, whereby green growth is like using our existing economic systems but making them greener, using renewable energies and all that, but having degrowth is something where people start to consume less, would you, and where everything is kind of changed. What would you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, my vote would be for degrowth, for a circular economy, for sort of Tim Jackson, prosperity without growth. I mean, that for me is the nirvana. But I'm also conscious that we need to carry people with us on this journey. And I talk a bit in the book about how, you know, the whole politics around Trump were around jobs and coal, vis-a-vis actually the many thousands more jobs that are being generated in the US on renewable energy. But I feel like we have to tell a story about jobs and growth, but it's better growth. Otherwise, we risk losing politically. And it's easier to tell a story about jobs and growth within the existing system than the whole degrowth story. But of course, I think we should be consuming much less and having living within a much more circular economy.
All of these big questions and pathways and stories that can kind of make or break whether or not what direction we put climate change on. And then you said that we as LSE students could be a big part of this, a big part of the solution. But you've given us sort of so many different parts of the story and so many different paths. And I was wondering if, you know, you had any guidance or advice or ideas about sort of what the most important things are and what we as LSE students could do, or at least the way we could think about making the most possible impact.
Thank you for asking that. Priorities. Yes, yes.
Or a way to think, I mean, even if you can't give us priorities, sort of a way to think about how to prioritize.
I mean, I think, and what I've tried to do in my life is basically work out, you know, and I don't think I've done this particularly successfully, but it's effectively, you know, where can I do the most good and exercise the most power in the most responsible fashion? And then apply that to your own life. And so in some instances, you know, it might be a question of returning to your country and trying to work for the government or for a company or for an NGO. In some cases, it might be, you know, doing that here. I sort of, and I'm 37 going on 38, I've sort of stumbled into where I've got to now after a fairly eclectic career of, you know, UN and Oxfam and the Colombian government and so on, and now WRI, and I'm very, very happy at WRI because I think it's a really good institute with lots of influence and lots of very good people doing good work. But my advice would be, you know, follow your heart, work out where you think you can make the most difference. And then be really bullish about making it happen. You know, don't be shy about knocking on doors, creating your own perfect job, you know, really going for it, and sort of finding your way, and being true to yourself and your values and what you most care about. And I wouldn't rule anything out. You know, I've got friends who've ended up working for big companies, and they're actually doing a lot of good on the inside. I've got friends who are working for radical NGOs. I've got friends working for governments. And I think you can make a difference wherever you are. And it might be a modest difference. I mean, I feel I've made a very modest impact, if any, frankly, over the last 15 years. And you have to keep yourself in check about that. But we can all make a contribution. And one of the interviews I did for the book was with Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury in the UK. And he basically said, you know, along the lines of, you know, the important thing, even if we're not winning this war that we've set ourselves, you know, you've just got to live right. You've got to do everything that you can. You know, it's ethically the right thing to do in and of itself. You can also do a huge amount from the academic world. I mean, I have huge respect for people who are teaching this issue, working here. Joanna, who was my contemporary at the LSE, has gone on to do incredible things with the law and climate. And, you know, so I think find your way and go for it would be my advice.
And then if you were to have to prioritize sort of those 10 different paths, you know, three or four that are the most critical?
Wow, I mean, I think they're all incredibly important. I mean, renewables, forests, agriculture, water, biodiversity, the ocean, cities, waste, people. I mean, and in fact, they're all linked. So in a sense, it's slightly arbitrary sort of distinction. I mean, my personal view, if you really force me, if I could do one thing over the next 30 years, it would be to actually, you know, save the world's remaining forests. I mean, I think if we could do that and plant a few trillion trees along the way, the right trees in the right places, you know, that would make a wonderful contribution. So that's one cause for a lifetime. But they're all, I mean, solar energy, I mean, there's incredible things happening in solar and so on. Cities, I mean, that whole story, we're all going to be living in cities by 2030, or at least 70% of us. You know, sustainable cities, and there's a lot of very good thinking happening here at the LSE about that agenda. But I think where you can do the most, exercise the most power is something to think about. And I've often come back to the view that people in government actually have a lot of power. Senior civil servants, people who are working behind the scenes, actually delivering a lot. And then people who go into politics. And I, you know, that still remains a dream for me. I'm just a bit lost politically at the moment. But I think politics is important. So, yeah.
So Ed, I think, you know, with your role at WRI, it's an important role, it's a very public role. But I'd just like to ask before we finish soon, you know, when I think about the average taxpayer in this country, with this audience here, we're pushing an open door. Everyone here cares about the environment in a different way. Everyone has their own sort of pet sort of love when it comes to the environment. When we think about the average person, the average taxpayer who has to pay for all of this, how have we bring them on board? You know, when we look at the elections and the political system, if people don't vote for environmental policy, they vote for lots of other things typically, and you see the Green polling at 4 or 5%. So, you know, how do we bring the mass of people on board who may have a worries to wear, but every night, but also got new there, bombarded with plastic waste one night, the next night Amazon fires, and they don't know what to think. So how do we, have we got any ideas about how we might sort of bring these kind of people on board?
Yeah. Yes, yes, exactly. Well, I think making the issues really immediate and very clear and not being preachy and holier than thou about it. And I worry about Extinction Rebellion potentially alienating some, although actually it's been amazing to see how lots of the public really do support and admire Extinction Rebellion. But I think just being very clear, very fact-based, telling a clear story about what can be done is very powerful. And then making environmental issues related to people's daily lives in terms of the economics of daily life, you know, people's spending every month, you know, and things that people really care about. I also think putting it more into the education system is important. Because lots of children, of course, are lobbying their parents on these issues, and there's this huge generational shift that's happening. So those would be two ideas, but baking it into the mainstream. And here in the UK at the moment, you know, it's actually the case that the Conservative Party are, you know, there are a lot of them who are very committed on the environment. And that's also quite interesting, because if they do win the next election as a result of all that's happening at the moment, notwithstanding lots of misgivings about what's happening here, there could actually be a period where there's a lot of UK leadership on the environment. Equally, it could go in the wrong direction, and Brexit could lead to a real relaxing of environmental standards that we've been committed to in the EU. So there's a lot to play for here as well.
Any final questions?
So you're talking about how you work a lot with like developing countries, and I understand that a lot of these countries are like big emission, play a big role in emitting carbon dioxide, but the government is still more focused on like lifting people out of poverty and more like just like poverty in general. So do you think like countries who are already more developed should help them, and if so, how?
So I definitely think we should honour our commitments to support countries, including countries like Indonesia, with climate finance to support the country on its journey. But what I do think is we need to tell a really powerful economic story about how the low-carbon economy is good for jobs, good for growth, And the study that I referenced in Indonesia, which is called the Low Carbon Development Initiative, actually showed that if Indonesia pursues, it's basically a kind of Stern review for Indonesia, and it shows that if the country really pursues a low carbon development trajectory, that would actually generate millions of good jobs, it would generate more sustainable economic growth in the long run. And so I think telling a story there about how doing the right thing by the environment is actually good for jobs and good for growth is probably our best strategy. And to sort of overcome this dichotomy where leaders feel that it's either growth and jobs or the environment, and actually you can have both. I interviewed around 50 people, and the only one who didn't want me to record him was Sir David Attenborough, that starts the book. And he was wonderful, and he talked about how he had seen so much, and he was worried about the future, but he was optimistic that people were watching his programs like never before, and so on. But most of the other interviews, people were happy to be recorded, and I told them that I had a little sort of collection of these interviews on YouTube. And so I just had a recorder, and I recorded them. And most of them have only been listened to about 30 or 40 times. But one of them, the one with Rowan Williams, the Archbishop, because he's well known, that one's been seen 10,000 times or something like that. So it just became part of the project. So I was crowdfunding for the book, doing the interviews, and you know, it just had a sort of life of its own, the whole project, basically. But some of them are well worth listening to. There's one with Paul Polman, one with... of formerly CEO of Unilever, one with Cristiana Figueres, who did the Paris Agreement. And they're all about half an hour long, I'll say. So.
Good question in methodology. Just have one more, and then we're going to let it sit down.
I'm really quick on time. Joe, I'm a former EMBA advisory. You mentioned the Renaissance Dam in Ethiopia and like the implications for water security and irrigation downstream, like Egypt, so forth. And I wonder whether from your WRI perspective, how do you see these sort of tensions around quite legitimate interests, you know, energy needs and development and irrigation and agriculture? How do you see them be resolved in the future? Because it seems to be kind of a canary in a coal mine, isn't it, situation?
It is a huge worry. I mean, there is a very interesting historical argument, which is effectively over the last 3,000 years, there's never been a significant transboundary water conflict. Nations have had a history of transboundary water cooperation. India and Pakistan have had four wars since 1950, but they've never breached the treaty that they signed in terms of the management of the river that they share. Now, climate change and the perfect storm that we have before us, you know, doesn't mean that that's not going to happen in the 21st century. And so basically this is going to require transboundary water diplomacy, ombudsmanship, independent brokers between the countries. And in the case of Ethiopia, Egypt, Sudan, South Sudan, my understanding is that they've basically so far been open to a degree of independent mediation where they come to some kind of agreement about, you know, how much water is kept in Ethiopia, how much is allowed downstream, and so on. But, you know, this is going to be a huge challenge, and, you know, it's going to require a lot of collaboration and so on. And the one that really keeps me awake at night is the Himalayan rivers and the glacier melt that's happening in the Himalayan region. And given that that basically feeds India and China, I mean, that's the one that I really worry about. But you tell me, I mean, you know more about the semantics than I do.
Okay, should we wrap up
there?
Is there anything else?
Well, no, just thank you so much for coming. Feel free to write to me if you want, ed.davey@wri.org. And thank you very much for coming out on a cool Thursday evening at the other team. Have a nice evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.